Something wrong with the pussy. Something wrong with the pussy. Something wrong with the pussy.
What's your electricity bill?
Oh my god.
Not electricity, but yeah, like during the utility
winter
time, bills.
Especially right now, it's been insane. Like this winter, I think January was like $800-$900.
Just utility.
Yeah.
Because this is your home too. This doubles as home.
Yeah.
Jesus, dude. Well, beyond the camera here, I'm sitting with a new friend, Keely, Ryan.
What's up,
Keely?
What's up?
Incredible artist. I mean, you'll tell everybody what you, I don't want to like do that whole thing. Like, tell me about your life. But dude, this is sick. Like, met very quickly and now we're here already recording. So this is like
amazing.
Pretty sick. Dude, I love New York for that.
Jump into it.
Jump right into it. We have Ghost who will be coming in and out of frame here. Ghost is, I think that's just a great story to start with. What's the story of Ghost?
The newest edition, the story of the Ghost. Ghost, you want to come here and get in? I'm sure he'll show us.
Yeah, he'll pop in.
But yeah, it's pretty insane. He, you know, it was actually, there's so much like crazy symbolism and how he arrived and what's going on with it. It's like pretty much changed my life. So like, yeah, on what was it? April 2nd, which was Passover weekend, I get an Amazon delivery, and the Amazon driver comes up and he hands me my package. And he's like, "Yo, there's a dog sitting outside your door bleeding." And I was like, "What?" So I go downstairs, and this beautiful white dog is just covered in blood, and he's got a like a iPhone cord around his neck as his leash. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? Where did you come from?
Got to be charged.
He's charged.
He's trying to charge his phone.
He's definitely unplugged. Definitely unplugged and unhinged. And who knows what the fuck was going on. But yeah, so he had no collar, no tag, no chip, no nothing.
Yeah.
And so I bring him to the vet and they were like, yeah, we'll hold on to him for, you know, a week and see if anybody claims him. Nobody claimed him. Then they bring him to the ACC and nobody claimed him. So they told me they're gonna off him if I didn't come get him. So I feel like I was compelled. There's a reason he showed up at my door and of all the doors in New York and the world.
What if you you're out walking him one day and like I'm assuming the person that is like unhoused, homeless. Yeah. What if that person runs up on you and is like, "Yo, that's my dog."
I'm going to be like, "Yo, I feel for you. And like, I mean, you should maybe come pay him visits or figure something out," but he left him for dead. He was going to die if I didn't, you know, didn't take him. And, you know, maybe the fact that he had an iPhone cord around his neck, the guy's phone has just been uncharged since
he's trying to call him.
He just hasn't been able to charge his phone.
He wasn't mad he lost Ghost. He was mad he lost the iPhone cord. He's like, I can't charge my damn phone.
If only there was another iPhone cord in New York, he could find his dog. But yeah, I mean, the fact he still had his balls. He had no tag, no chip, no nothing.
He still have his balls? Did he get clipped?
So that's the one thing that they had to do before they delivered him to me was give him his shots, neuter him, and I begged him not to.
It's America, man. It's taking all the man's balls away. It's just a state of Biden's horrible. America.
Yeah. It's a horrible thing. It's very sad. I'm sure he had a great set of nuts on him, and they were just, you know, just staring at
him. It's half the man he used to be. Yeah. Well, I'm glad Ghost has a great home here, but you did mention to me, and I haven't really asked you about it in depth yet. I want to save it for this. You're somehow involved in the process of acquiring Kanye's home.
Oh, so this is...
in which home?
The Malibu one. Yeah, so I have I have a long, weird history with him anyway. I was in, you know... We've done certain projects in the past and just had very, you know, different run-ins. And this time I had a friend who was involved in the sale of the house, and he called me and we did a couple like marketing tactics together. So in a weird way, I helped promote the house, and then that led to a sale.
What was your involvement with the promotional pieces?
They hit me up and I did, you know, the first idea was we were going to do an art show in the home, you know, in the raw space. It was a Tadao architecture space. And he took all the windows out and the plan was to turn it into like a bomb-proof bunker in the right on the beach in Malibu, which, apparently didn't work out. I don't think the people of Malibu
were it's a bit of an eyesore.
Yeah, so that happened, and then they actually it changed hands a couple times. So it's more so in developers' hands right now, and I think the goal is probably still this summer. We're still going to exercise doing an art show and something to, you know, raise the value and raise awareness.
Would the art show be in protest of Kanye, or what would the nature of the art show be?
I admire the guy.
Just turn it into a Holocaust museum.
I've actually gotten presented with the idea by.
I mean, in Malibu, you'd have a lot of people that would be like, you know.
Yeah, that's. I got presented with the idea to do that not too long ago, and I think it's. You know, I would love to do something like that. I think the idea is to do like a Malibu fire benefit instead of that. I kind of want to steer clear of doing anything too racially motivated or anything to make, you know, I feel like giving it some good energy and doing something positive in there is probably the right move.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. The people of the Palisades need the money. No, I mean, it's like, you want to make fun of them and shit them, but it's like, if you, and no matter who you are, no matter how well off you are, losing your home and like all your possessions is like, that's,
oh yeah,
that's the hard reset. No matter like how well off you are, that's awful.
I had a lot of good friends that lost their homes in the fire.
Yeah,
and it was like, holy shit, you know, like I can't imagine, you know, losing everything. I had a good friend who had an amazing house right on the beach in Malibu, and it just went to dust. Like literally, not a thing left in there.
Jesus.
So yeah, it's pretty insane to see. So.
So when it's not acquiring a home from Kanye, where else, just so people that are listening know who you are and what you've done and how you've gotten to this space as an artist, like also you've worked closely with Lauryn Hill forever. Like how did that relationship come about?
So I've been an artist pretty much my entire life. You know, my earliest memories were drawing and painting as a child.
Yeah.
Since I was like, you know, two, three years old, since I was, little kid. And then throughout school growing up, I basically was a kid that just sat in the art room, didn't have to go to any other classes, started doing that, and then, you know, moved on and just been an artist my whole life. And through that, I've met a lot of amazing people, a lot of people in the music industry and entertainment industry. Mm. One of my good friends introduced me to Lauryn 10, 12 years ago.
Mm.
And we were just supposed to sit down and have a 30-minute meeting, and we ended up staying up all night and talking all through the night. And then next thing you know, I was doing her stages and putting artwork, you know, into all different types of projects with her.
I mean, anytime working with Lauryn Hill was probably just like open doors into that whole like industry. It's like how, I don't know, like what like made it just kind of stick or like connect with her where she was like, oh, I really like this guy. Like I can see this becoming a now like a 10-year long relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really foresee it us rocking this long because we are very much, you know, we are complete opposites. We're like yin and yang. But it works perfectly. We complement each other great. You know,
yeah.
Every time I love working with people that, you know, I love presenting myself with a challenge. And if you know anything about her, she's notorious for like, you know, certain people can get along with her, and she's just a, you know, she's an enigma of an artist that not a lot of people can handle. But I saw it as a challenge, and I stepped up to bat and helped her facilitate some of the, you know, wild ideas that she has. And I'm always down to, you know, to rock with, you know, crazy ideas. And, you know, after I completed one thing, she threw me another, and we just kept making cool shit.
Are there any other artists that you have worked with, not because of, but like any other like hip hop, R&B, or any other artists, like music artists that you've
he hit me one day, and I had a studio right up the street, and he's like, yo, I got this young guy, he needs a place to shoot a music video. You know, you think we could just slide through and shoot a couple scenes in your studio? And that ended up being Kendrick Lamar. Like,
when was this?
This is like 2010 like or 11. We did the video for Rigor Mortis in my studio.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So if you go back and look at that, you know, all the artwork that's in the background is all my artwork. And he was just, it was one of the first, you know, I think this was off of Section 80.
So yeah.
He came into town, and he did one other video of Vashti, where they were like running around in an office building. Can't remember the name of the song that was for. And then Rigor Mortis was the song that we had. And basically he came and my friend was directing it and producing the video. And then I kind of stepped in and I was like designing the set and giving him ideas. We had him out rhyming in the middle of Bowery. Like just fucking like.
Oh, literally. So that video, I never knew that video was shot in New York.
Yeah.
Right here.
Yeah,
like
right outside. Right, like, outside. Right up the street. It was at my old studio at across the street from Bowery Hotel.
Is then wow, that was Ali's one of my good friends. I know few guys in that yeah. camp, but that those it's crazy. I've heard like more early Kendrick stories recently because of some of the guys I've gotten to know more, like in that camp in particular, but I never knew that. I love that.
That actually that piece on the wall right there is the sign that he was holding in the middle of Bowery. It says, what does it say? Please help. We'll kill your favorite rapper for money trying to get back to LA. So I actually...
should have him sign that or something.
No, I tried to hit Dave, and I haven't been able to get in touch with Dave. I hit his manager. I hit a couple other people, but I was trying to like tell him to come out at the Super Bowl holding it. But I don't think that I don't think they want something that says like kill your favorite rapper for money. I mean, you know, you could call someone a pedophile at the Super Bowl, but yeah. I don't think they wanted to talk about killing people.
Yeah, murders crossing the line. Yeah. Pedophiles chill. Yeah, that's Jesus, dude. Yeah, that's a funny.
And my boy Daryl Filth, when all this started happening, I just happened to with all the Drake stuff, I just put a photo up of him holding that. And I was like, oh, this photo aged well. And then Daryl was like, yo, you know what I still have? And he's got like, Daryl's got like a, like, you know, like the time capsule of all this old artifacts from all these old hip hop videos and stuff. So he brought that over and I framed it.
Oh, so he had it. Okay,
yeah,
sick.
Yeah.
What does Daryl do in the...
He does like a lot of music video production.
Oh, cool.
Now he actually runs ASAP Foundation for Yam's mom. He's involved in that, so we did a bunch of work with that. That's actually a piece over there of Yams that I did for his mother.
Sick.
I've got a couple other pieces for ASAP stuff that we've done in here as well.
I was gonna ask, I mean, being in New York and being an artist here for so long, like I feel like that's a crew that would naturally make sense with like your kind of art.
Well, I used to be my studio was right over by the Black Scale store.
Oh yeah,
on Elizabeth Street. So Mega was a friend of mine, and and all the ASAP kids used to come through there and grab up gear from him, and so we would hang out with him.
That's awesome.
You know, I actually ran into him not too long ago and it was like, you know, I hadn't seen him in years and it was like, you know, good little reunion.
Is the music space your preferred like collaborative space for your art? Or
I mean, it just kind of happened naturally. Like, I think I always wanted to be a musician, but I just sucked at playing instruments and I was so much more of a visual person. But doing stages and getting to go on tour with musicians, like, you know, I did Gary Clark Jr.'s art direction for a long time. And he's like, you know, blues guitar player, like the sickest guitar player on the planet. And he would always say, he'd be like, oh, you're the sixth member of the band, you know? And like, as that's I would do the nice. Visuals.
Yeah.
So that was like, and I was like, oh, sick. Like, finally get to be a rock
Didn't
star.
You do his, you mentioned you designed the fit he wore to the Grammys.
Oh yeah. The only piece of high fashion that I've done just yet. I might be doing another one.
What year was this?
It was right before the pandemic. So
like 18 or 19.
No, this was the Grammys 2020.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So like 2 weeks before the Grammys, you know, we were just making all kinds of stuff for him. And I was like, yo, what are you going to wear? And he was like, I don't know. And I was like, why don't I make you a suit? And he's like, do you know how to make a suit? I was
like, do you know how to sew?
And I was like, no, but I'll figure it out. Just like everything else, you know? So I was in LA at the time. And, you know, with all my artwork, I use a lot of printers and stuff. So it's like a mixed media paint, print process. So I was like, oh, if I can do this on canvas, I can do this on fabric as well.
Yeah.
So I bought a bolt of Laura Piana velvet and I was staying at the Dream Hotel. I'll never forget. Like my boy gave
me. Right in WeHo.
Yeah. And so I destroyed this fucking hotel room with paint. I had like, you know, the fabric laid out across the bed and I was like.
But you did it in the hotel room? Oh my God. Yeah.
So I've got video of it all too. So I do this bolt of.
How much in damages was that?
It way exceeded the budget. Way exceeded the budget. I don't think I ever got charged for that one. I think somehow I weaseled my way out of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we did. I made the bolt to Laura Piana Velvet, and then I found a flatbed UV printer in, like, you know, somewhere in Studio City or something like that, and brought it back and forth. So the process was like paint, print, do multiple levels. And then, so I get the fabric done, and then I find this guy down in, you know, somewhere like Koreatown or something that did the cut and sew. I took one of Gary's old suits and I traced the pattern.
Yeah. Oh, so you had the measurements. You were like, all right, this is, this is going to be some old shit.
You know, it wasn't the hardest thing, you know, I've ever had to figure out. I had like the pattern and everything. So then I found a guy to help me sew it. I couldn't learn how to sew within a couple days.
Yeah, that's fair.
So he put it together. We did a couple fittings, and I think we delivered it 2 hours before the Grammys started. They were bugging. I remember we were sitting at, we were sitting at the hotel, and he was like, "Yo, I don't have a backup outfit." He was like, "This thing is going to be delivered in time." And I'm sitting there like, "Fuck, dude," calling this guy like 1,000 times. And then he delivered it, and it looked amazing. And I'll never forget, like, he walked the red carpet in it.
Yeah.
Everybody was like, "Who are you wearing?" And he's like, "Oh, this fucking guy Healy made it for me.
Dumbass friend that delivered it 10 minutes ago."
And then he performed that night with the Roots, and it was fucking amazing. He performed like the, you know, this epic song with fire in the background and all kinds of shit, and it was great. And then I thought, like, I was like, oh, this is my big chance to be a fashion designer.
Yeah.
And I talked to a couple people, and I got offered a studio in New York and a bunch of like a team and infrastructure to do this line, to continue on with it. And then boom, the pandemic happened like the next week, and side railed all that shit. So
how did, when the pandemic happened, I'm always curious to know like how creatives pivoted, or like what their source of income was. Cause like, what do you do?
Well,
I mean, you could still paint and sell pieces, but like, what does that look like?
I just went and drank ayahuasca in Brazil fucking for a long time.
So you said fuck work.
I'm detaching from the world.
I thought
reality was just over as we knew it. And I was like, yo, if this is the end of the world, I'm fucking going out strong.
Tell me about that. How was that trip? I've never done it. Always been curious. I don't think I have the, obviously, I was going to say the word tolerance, but like, that's one of those drugs that doesn't matter.
It's really, like, honestly, like, I feel like it's very tame. Like, I've done it many times, and a lot, and some of the times I've done it with like a mother and daughter, like you know, people that
it's always like communal, right? You're never just like dolo, you and a shaman.
I hate that.
It's like shitting bricks, throwing up on each other.
Well, I never would get violently ill.
Really?
Like other people. I think that's because I just wasn't full of shit to begin with. But like, yeah, that was one of the things, is like, I hated sitting around. Like, I'd be having this like glorious epiphanies and breakthroughs, and then you got to listen to some asshole throwing up next to you. And I would just go off.
Yeah, wouldn't that like break your...
That's what it completely distracted me. I feel like some people need like a communal experience to get through it, and like have like somebody holding your hand, but I've done so many psychedelics.
When you went to Brazil, was it alone, or did you like go with someone to say, "Hey, we've always wanted to do this. Let's do this together."
No, well, that was kind of a different, I was going upstate with a friend of mine. Like I lasted in the city like a month or two into the pandemic. And then when the riots and all that shit started happening, my friend was like, "Yo, I got this place upstate. Do you want to come hang out up there with me?" And then we just ended up, I was hanging out with him, and then I was just like, "Yo, I went to Walmart and bought a tent and pitched it by the river." It was fucking checked
went full
out.
Walden. Yeah.
I was like, "This is the perfect time. I just need to go like hang out by myself and just fucking chill." And then I did. I was upstate with him for maybe like a month or so through the summer, and then I came back, and then I had a really good friend of mine. He just randomly called me one day. And he was like, "Yo, we're down in Brazil." His family is from there. And he was like, "My buddy's like, he loves your artwork. He's like, he thought it'd be cool for you to come down for a week or two and just make some art." And so I'm like, I intended on only going down there for like 2 weeks. And then I ended up staying there for a couple months.
Wow.
And that was amazing.
Did the ayahuasca and all this shit, did it change or develop a new type of art or a new spectrum on it, life at all?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, every time you do it, you have like amazing breakthroughs and just like, you know.
What? Like what? Tell me.
I mean, I don't know anything's too specific, but it just makes you, I feel like I'm much more aware and in tune with like, you know, the universe, and like, it kind of gives me a little bit of a God complex. I fucking feel like I'm you know, I go through this like invincible stage when I'm kind of done with it. But
they always say it's like the drug or the experience of not even to that extreme, ayahuasca and those like hard psychedelics, but even like a drug like Molly, or I guess in some cases shrooms. Like if you're a narcissist, or if you're someone that's like very, like you said, like a god complex type of thing, it's like it's the one drug that can shake that. And it's terrifying to people that have those things because they're not used to being so affectionate and outwardly showing love, that they have like a breakdown from the thought of releasing, not seeing themselves as the center of the universe and like giving themselves to the universe, so to speak. I did acid in South Africa with Boz 2022. We flew out for like a month, and I did it once in the bush. First time, only time ever done acid. First and last. I would do it again. I just don't want to do it here. Yeah, it's like I come back to New York, I'm like, I'm not trying to do this on Bowery.
acid in the city is like, I've done it a million times, and it's definitely a whole different, you know, I do feel like being connected to nature when you're doing it is important.
Yeah,
it's a whole different trip when you do it in the city. It's like, you know,
so when you're in the bush, it's you get there, you do it an afternoon ride, and then we have 10 villas. There were 10 of us out there. We each had our own private villa, and it was beautiful. We had dinner, like private chef, the whole thing. And then you do the sunset ride. And then it's like, we were like, all right, it's nighttime. We're safe in the villa. We're not going out like after the nighttime ride. But it's like, let's all just fucking, there's a bonfire. Let's take acid for the night ride, catch that on the ride. And then it'll hit us like at the, you know, throughout the night. We'll stay up until the morning ride. That's kind of the whole thing. Yeah. Stay up through the night. I mean, I went through so many stages. Like I was fearful because I'd never taken it. So I went through like fear. And then I went through the purest joy and laughter. I was laughing like a baby. Like it was like, I was so happy. And then I cried, but like a happy cry, and then an emotional cry about like my family. And then I started to see like our humans' connectivity with the universe and the earth and like all the animals that were surrounding me in the wilderness. Like it shook my entire neuron, like my neuroses were just, synapses were just firing at levels I couldn't even process.
Yeah.
And it was just like the coolest thing ever. But I don't think I could do it again unless I'm in a setting like that.
Yeah. I mean, I've done it in multiple settings, and some of the best, I mean, every time is so different. Every time teaches you something different, amazing.
Yeah.
I started doing it when I was pretty young, and I had a lot of amazing breakthroughs, and that's kind of like what propelled me into like, you know, being an artist or actually, you know, deciding that that's what I was doing for my life and everything. But I mean, I think it's, you know, I think everybody needs to experience it at some point. It definitely changes your whole view on it.
I think there's like the obviously like the Reagan era politics was very scare. Mm-hmm. Do this, you'll fry your brain. Do this, you'll die. But then at the same time, they were seeing the, you know, actual benefits and scientific advancements that it could do to people, that treating like Alzheimer's and like all these other neurodegenerative diseases. So it's like you're vilifying it to the public, but behind closed doors, you see the benefit of the value of it. So I think it's like unlearning the scare tactics. Like I've spoken to my mom pretty openly about this stuff. She's like anti all this stuff, but she can now come around and see, it's like, all right, like I get it. It wasn't for our generation. We were scared shitless, but like it makes sense in terms of like where it's.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think they definitely vilified it for a while because it's, you know, definitely relinquishes control over, you know, people and the population. Once you see you can be free, you know, you can't have.
You know, once you realize how stupid all of this is. Yeah.
And that's kind of like, you know, even I was talking to a friend of mine who's very like, you know, just tuned into the whole political climate day in and day out. And I was like, bro, you got to fucking check the fuck out of this. Like turn the TV off for a little bit.
During the pandemic, that was tough for me. Cause it was so, especially during the BLM stuff, I was like, oh, like this directly relates to me. But it's also using awful. It's just so like scary and dark and just like, you know, blacks versus whites every day. Is this person right? Is that person right? And you just scroll. It's just like, it was too much.
Yeah.
It was way too much.
Even recently I've just been like, all right, like I got to fucking turn this off.
Yeah.
And really in reality, it's like, once you turn it off and you get out of that like zone of like paying attention to every bit of news. It's like, how much does this really affect my life? You know, like I've been realizing like a lot of people, it's like, you know, it weighs them down and kind of takes their focus off of what really matters.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to, you know, cleanse my, like going to a political diet where like I only want to know enough that like affects me directly. And like, you know,
I was reading a article. It was like watching something. I don't know where I've heard this or read it. It was something like the greatest myth ever. And it was talking about, you know, the religion and all these different things that, you know, keep people in check or control people. And it's like the greatest myth in this country, like developed, is basically just any form of currency. Money in itself just means, I mean, quite literally nothing. We saw again during the pandemic, like housing markets. I paid a fucking quarter of what my apartment's worth. It's like none of this is real. Like it doesn't.
It's all social, you know, socially developed perspective. And, you know, it's like really like if you can change the perspective of all the people, you can change the trajectory of everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, even when I'm watching like markets go up and down, like, you know, I'll get trapped into that. Like, you know, I'll get trapped into like, you know, the whole crypto markets. And,
Ghost is chilling.
Yeah, it's good. Like getting something like this completely to get your attention away from dumb shit like that. Like,
yeah.
You know, have a dog just show up at your front door.
How does especially when you're a creator and an artist, I mean, in terms of creating, you have to set your own value. How did you scale up the value of your business as you went along? It's like, okay, I worked with this person, now my rate's this, or like I'm using this expensive fabric and paint, now my rate's this, or what?
I mean, I think it's all perceived value. It's like,
yeah,
you know, I wish I, like early on, if I would have just known to set your prices high from the get-go. And you don't really got to climb a ladder. Like I see artists today, just like they'll start, you know, start painting. And then 2 months in, they're like, oh yeah, 100K, 500K. And you're just like, people are like, oh, okay. He says that's the price.
That's the price. Price. Yeah.
Know? Like I used to be like, you know, actually have some type of morals and not want to charge people like exuberant amounts for my artwork. And now it's just like, you know, you got to get what you can for it sometimes, but you know,
is it like in the in when you're creating a piece, is it like, when you're like determining the value of something, is it the materials and the paint and the canvas or whatever itself, or you're like, if I'm spending this much time on something, it means I'm not making money doing these other things, or is it all those things? Like what's the,
I think it's a very weird science when you price something out. I kind of justify it now not so much on time, you know, time. Every time someone's like, how long did this take you? I'm like, oh, my whole life, you know?
True. Yeah. So
I think what I really price it on is how it makes me feel. And if I love it, then I charge higher for it. If I'm like, oh, like I didn't put my all into it, then I'll give a little discount on it, you know?
Have you had those pieces in the past where you're like, I don't want to give this away, and then offers the right price and you're like,
early on, when I was first starting, like I was in love with every piece and I never wanted to sell anything, and it was like taking a piece of my soul or like taking my baby away.
Yeah.
But now I'm just like, you know, I can like, the next one is always the best one, so I could.
It's a good place to be in. Yeah. I mean, even down to your pants, the pants that you sold the other day. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. We can sell the byproducts. That's what I always say, like, even the paintings are a byproduct. Like, you know, your life should be the piece of art, and then everything else kind of just flakes off. And, you know,
how would you describe, like, what type of art do you do? Like, what are these type style of paintings?
Well, I guess like early on I had to come up with a name for it. So we started calling it hybrid expressionism, because it is expressionist work.
Yeah.
Expressionist paintings are just kind of stream of thought. And then I started calling it hybrid because I use printing machines and analog paint methods and basically whatever's in the room. So I had one of my best friends and my early collectors buy me this large format printer. Not this one.
Oh, it's like a different one. Okay. That thing is huge, by the way. Yeah. That is.
So I have like, I have like eight of those in storage. So I just keep them for parts and whatnot. But
it's like a 12-foot printer. laying up. That's my whole living room.
Yeah,
that would take up my whole living space.
If you saw how many people it took to get that up these stairs.
Oh my god! Fucking, yeah,
and it's probably never gonna leave this room.
How like, heavy is that? That thing is giant.
They're not too heavy. They're just very cumbersome to like move around.
Yeah.
But yeah, one of my best friends, he had the idea. He was always very entrepreneurial. And he was like, yo, he's like, you're making these great paintings. He's like, I'm going to buy this printer and then we'll make 100 prints of the paintings. And he wanted to like, you know, invest in, you know, printmaking. And the printer just sat in the studio forever. And I never really was into making prints.
Prints, you know,
I kind of, you know, just wasn't my thing.
Wasn't that Warhol kind of like revolution? Didn't he? Yeah. He had played a big part in like just fucking press it out.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is more so like, you know, we're just going to make digital editions of it. So it sat in the studio forever. And then late one night, I was on a bunch of acid and I come back and I was like, oh, I wonder what happens if I paint on canvas and then run it through the printer. And it lasted for maybe like, you know, printed for 5 minutes and then it just clogged and broke and shut down. And so like the next day or two, once I come back to reality, I call my boy and I'm like, yo, you know that printer you bought? I fucked it up. And he's like, you idiot. So he's like, all right, it's going to take like 2 to 3 weeks for the tech to come out and look at it and fix it.
Unclog it.
And so during that time, I started just taking screws apart and getting inside of it. And I realized what caused it to break. And then I had a couple ideas of what I could do to make it not break the next time. And then I augmented the software a little bit. So what I achieved was a way of being able to run wet paint through the printer. So it's kind of like how it's kind of like how Warhol used to paint first and then screen print on top of the painting.
Yeah.
I can paint first and then digitally print. And then I paint again and print again and paint again. So I'll like roll, it'll print out, I'll paint and then roll it back up and then let it go again.
Wow.
So it creates these like very like, you know, these are all very much unfinished. So these are not the best examples, but I like to create these like real dynamic layers of depth so you can always like look more and more and more. And I feel like if you're going to collect a piece of art, you want to be able to look at it forever and always find new little
something different.
Things.
Yeah.
And, you know, my favorite thing is when I'll have a collector like move homes or something and then hit me and be like, yo, I just hung this piece in this new room and now I see this and I see this.
The way the light hits it is different now.
Yeah,
like,
just
yeah.
Like there's so many layers underneath it and I'll, you know, print photos and then completely cover them to where like, it might not be the first thing that you see when you look at it. But if you look like, you know, look at it for 10 years, you'll always find something different. And I feel like if you're going to collect a piece and you're going to have to look at it for your whole life, maybe you have a couple little Easter eggs in there.
Yeah.
You know,
do you ever play with texture?
Yeah. I mean, that's like, one of the other things I was telling you earlier is I created my own paint company with one of my best friends, Matt, that I've known since I was like, you know, 10 years old. And that's one of the things that we're doing now is playing with all different types of textures and stuff. So like I have, you know, this new suede paint where we're taking sand from famous surf beaches from all over the world. So like the main ingredient in suede paint is basically sand, which isn't the most, you know, could get it on a sandbox if you fucking wanted to, but like, I think it's cooler to like, you know, if you have a memory from a beach where you met your wife or something, then you can put that sand into the paint and then paint your home, and it's like, you know, creating
would that create like a grainy or how would it sit?
It's basically like you've seen it before in certain places, like you might not notice it, but next time you go into a place and it has like a very rough texture, you know, if you rub your hand on it, it feels almost
like a sandpaper.
That's just basically just sand additive to paint, but it's cool if you go to like, you know, I'm doing a project this summer where I'm painting a famous sculpture at Montauk Beach House, and so we're taking paint from Montauk and Costa Rica and Pipeline and other places and shipping it in and making like special batches of paint.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah,
what's you mentioned the Montauk like project. How do most of your products come in? Like do you kind of like say, all right, I want to do this or I don't want to do this. Like, what's the process of like picking? Is it like a vibe thing? It's like, all right, I could spend a week or two in Montauk, or like, what's the, you know, what?
Well, I mean, that doesn't sound too shitty.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess it's kind of like, you know, sometimes, I don't know, you got to weigh it. Like, sometimes, like, I always say, if you're learning something, or if you're making money, or, you know, you have to have, like, you know, a good mix of things. Like, sometimes I'll whore myself out for cash if it's the right amount for a shitty project that I don't really want to do. But I like to limit that. Like, if I'm, like, you know, having fun, or, you know,
yeah,
learning something, that's the best. You know, if you're making cash, that's great too.
How much clothing have you destroyed in the process of?
This is
the first time I've seen you with, yeah, no paint.
Yeah,
the SBs are clean, so yeah, I love the.
Thank you for my. It's, yeah, funny because one of my childhood friends that used to work, we used to work at a skate shop together in North Carolina, and now he's managing the Supreme store, which is two doors down.
Oh,
from,
yeah,
me. So every time I need something not covered in paint, I just run over there and he hooks it up.
I was a big SB kid.
Yeah.
I got to get back into the.
Dude, these, I actually ordered, I got these off of eBay. Fucking, I was just like bored the other night and I was like, I want some old school fucking SBs. We were actually one of the first stores in North America at Vertical Urge in North Carolina to carry SBs.
Where in North Carolina did you grow up? Where was this?
I grew up in Raleigh, Durham.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I lived all over. I went to school. I tried to go to school. I dropped out after 2 weeks at Appalachian State.
2 weeks?
Yeah.
Did you even go? Like, well, how did that happen? Like, what's the...
It's, man. Yeah, so I moved up there. What was it? Like the summer or a year or two after high school. And then I was supposed to go to... I had like a waiting period because I applied late. So I was supposed to go to the community college, do a few classes, and then go and then start going to,
yeah,
the real university the next semester. And then I got an A+ in eating acid and psychedelics.
Wait, so is that okay? So back to the, is this still very much like prevalent? Like, how often are you, you know?
Not too much. Like, I feel like I've eaten so much LSD in the past, you know, it always spins you in a direction. And
yeah,
I'm in a great direction now, so I don't want to get spun or turned around, you know? So, you know, that's limited, you know, every now and then, like, you know, even though I feel, yeah, it's like, you know, when you're, it's a tool. So like, if you don't need to, you know, if you got a great car, you don't need to spend a lot of time in the garage working on it, you know? So
I'm going through not via the psychedelic route, but I've taken on therapy 3 weeks ago now. I'm on my third week.
Yeah,
it's fucking, it might as well be a drug, dude. I'm like, I'm hooked. Like, I'm obsessed with the process and like obsessed with, like, and now I've just become, I mean, to the extent that like on the show or with my family or whoever, like, I'm just like, all right, so then like, this is what I was thinking, like, this is actually what's happening, and I'm seeing this pattern here. To like, I went in with one very specific thing in mind, and it's just like become a pull the string and just like revealed so many more things that I need to work on that I've just been ignoring for my whole life.
I've never gotten into. I feel like I've always had, I mean, not professional therapy, but what I consider therapy is, like, you know, my art and like all these, I've had some of the most amazing mentors that have kind of like led me in the right direction.
Yeah.
But yeah. That's one road I'm yet to go down, is crack open all the trauma in my life.
I mean, yeah, like the art, I write a lot. I used to draw and paint a bit, but never like to the extent that I really should just get back and do it. But yeah, I kind of similarly would just get lost in my thoughts, just putting it on a paper or like putting it in a bit, yeah, or like going to the gym or just like just putting it outward, like any outward physical showing of emotion. So I feel like all artists.
Yeah, I mean, if I didn't do it, I would fucking explode. Like, thank God for paint, because I would probably be in jail or something, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think everybody has to have an outlet to get stuff out, whether it's, you know, doing like this podcast is an art for you. You know, it's like no matter what you're doing, as long as you're creating, you know, some people do it in a visual, you know, textural form in painting. Some people do it in this or,
yeah,
whatever.
But even with this, like, I mean, like, everyone's had bad experiences no matter how great or cool their job is. Like, have you had a shitty dealing with like a client or with an artist, and you're just like, maybe not to the extent of like, fuck this, I'm done, like as an artist, I'm shutting it all down, but like even when you're younger and you're like, I don't know if this is gonna work, like what about like any of like the doubting phases?
Yeah, I mean, as an artist, I go through that, like, maybe even not like a daily basis, but there's like a lot of ups and downs, you know, like there's no consistency. there's, you know, I've been through hell and back a million times where I'm like, you know how many times I've been like, fuck this, I should just get a regular job. And that ended a long time ago. There's no turning back now. But when I was younger, it was like, okay, am I really going to do this? And like, you know, there was never really a question, but it's like something that's always on your mind. Like, is this the right step? Is this the right path? Is this going to, you know, obviously I've always wanted comfort and stability, but I've always wanted chaos and fucking, you know, chaos and the insanity of living a great life to look back on.
I feel like you operate well within the chaos. I mean, that's also like a great artist. That's the whole beauty of it. It's like, no matter what the levels of financial success are, it's like you still need to operate in some level
even
of
even if I do have
great degeneracy.
I used to be the king of like, once I did get to a great comfortable place and be financially stable, I would self-sabotage just to get myself back into the fucking chaos.
Pull a Kanye and just
for real.
Throw it all away.
Yeah. I mean, but that's also what I used to do it, and now it for a while became kind of a drug, because once you could throw it all away and come back from it, then you're like, oh shit, like I couldn't fucking do anything.
That's when that invincibility really kicks in. You're like, I can say anything, print a t-shirt with a fucking swastika on it, like I'm still gonna be fine.
Yeah.
I listened to Donda 2 today, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I like Donda 2. It has a lot of, I think The Bully was my favorite of the last releases.
Really? That first track on Donda 2 is very good. I'm not trying to give Kanye any praise, but song is good.
Yeah. Was that's the one? That's the
True
XXX
Love.
Yes,
one. Yeah, True that Love. That's he's actually saying some stuff on that. And then he like the next few records he talked about.
I haven't had time. I listened to it the other day. I haven't had time to sit with it, but I think I've listened to Bully probably on repeat.
I haven't given that one a look. What is it? What is it with his obsession? I mean, I don't know who's this. The bags. Why is he the bag so much? He always talks about. I got a bag for the good Birkin, Celine, all this shit. That's all he talks about.
I mean, it's just, I think it's more of just like status symbol. Like, you know, just, he's always been like, you know, all about the chains and fucking all that shit. Like,
yeah.
You know, which I've never been like a, you know, luxury whore, but, you know, some people are, you know.
What are you, in terms of like musicians, who do you think has like the best taste art wise or just even fashion wise?
Best taste like fashion wise? I don't know. I mean, I've got to give it to Lauren and Miss Hill and our stylist team. I was getting in trouble for not calling her Miss Hill. Sorry about that. But yeah, no, I mean, she's got impeccable taste, and I've really learned to appreciate, like, you know, her choice of when and where to show up or what time to show up. And it's not like, you know, it's very, you know, I always used to be like, I feel like I was too accessible and like out in the world and out at all the clubs and out at every event, and now I'm trying to take a step back from that, and you know.
Okay, so you're learning from taking a page out of her.
Yeah, I think so. I think just recently, like, I kind of like I stepped into a space where all of a sudden I was just like out all the time, and you know, it wasn't like I want it to be a treat when people see me.
Build that level of mystique.
Yeah,
I feel like that's really been robbed in terms of celebrity artist culture. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone's too overexposed. I'm saying this as we're on a camera right now, but it's like everyone, there's too much visibility. There's too much, like, you know, I can see you on my phone every day if I really want to, and what you're doing in that exact moment. Whereas, like, I mean, the golden era of celebrity was just like the, you know, like the early, the Pussy Posse days. It was in New York with Leo, fucking Tobey Maguire, David Blaine, and E from Entourage. Yeah. I forget, I never remember his name. What is that guy's name?
Fuck. That just made my brain go
blank. Yeah, I don't know. Is it Kevin something? Doesn't matter. Yeah. But like, those guys were like terrors of New York.
Yeah, and
still are. Yeah, and they move like it's still the 90s. There's no cameras anywhere they go.
Yeah,
but I miss that. I wish we could experience that.
Yeah. I remember like when I first moved up here, going to all the clubs and stuff, and like with a lot of those guys, and there wasn't like, we would just be fucking out of our minds, but there was no, really not. Now I feel like everybody's like knows that there's cameras around. You gotta be guarded. You can't really go too crazy.
Yeah, because when did you move to New York? Like, when did you start going out here?
I got moved to New York. So I was in the midst of moving to Hawaii. And then one of my ex-girlfriends from high school, she introduced me to Peter Beard, the photographer. And I came to New York with her at one point, and I met him and a bunch of his friends, and we were like, yeah, we should work together sometime. And then at one point I just got a random phone call, and they were like, yo, we got a project for you. We want you to bring one of your printer machines to New York. And they gave me a place. They had it was kind of a rundown building, but it was on Houston West Broadway. And I had no, and I didn't really, and I knew New York, but I didn't really know, like, oh, this is like the fucking spot.
Yeah, you're in a great location.
So they set me up there, and then I was only supposed to come for 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks turned into, I've been here. That was 2007 or 2008. So.
Oh, wow. So you've been, yeah.
Yeah. Shit. I always say it's like, oh, I've been in New York for like 10 years. That's like fucking closer to 20. It's been a while.
So when you're not here, where do you usually spend like your time?
I've got family in North Carolina still. I'm still down there. I did have a house in Montauk for quite a bit, and then I got rid of that like before pre-pandemic.
Good.
I have a long history of like, I lived in Costa Rica for a long time with a bunch of my friends, and we all have houses down there, so I'm there. And then Brazil has become another place where I'm down a lot too. So
it's a great circuit.
Yeah.
How often are you in Costa Rica?
I haven't been going. I used to go like every other couple months, but now I'm there maybe like a few times a year.
How are you going to travel with this guy?
I mean, he's got a, I don't know.
I feel like he's going to be a terror on a plane.
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to figure that out. I'm like, fuck, I got to just make more money so I can fly private.
Yeah, you just get him on a plane, get him on his own plane.
I was thinking about, I just got a studio in South Carolina to make all the paint and stuff. It's like a big, massive warehouse, a couple buildings. So I think I'm going to get a truck again so I can
drive
down there. Yeah, I love driving. It's like I get my best thinking done behind the wheel. So it's like an 8-hour trip, but. I'm used to, when I was in high school, I used to drive from North Carolina to New York, like,
every
weekend, yeah.
Oh, so you started coming to, it's crazy, because like, I grew up upstate, like, right outside of Albany, and I hardly came to the city, ever. My parents, we just didn't do it, and then I lived in Chicago, and I knew I had to end up here at some point. I knew it was just going to happen, but, like, I wish when I was younger I had, like, that, like, experience of New York from, you know, the early, mid-2000s.
I mean, I came here quite a bit, you know, it's funny because even before I moved to New York, I just got a New York, like when you could pick your cell phone number, I just got a New York number because I was like, yo, like I just had a feeling I would end up here. Like, as an artist, it's like, you know, I kind of like, I knew I'd get here one day, and then one time I just got the opportunity and I just took it and never left.
What, 917?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just had to get a new phone, and I'm so lame. I made sure I could get. I just wanted to keep my 518. It's like, why? I've been here. I'm never gonna live upstate again. But like, I just wanted to hold on to it.
Yeah. But I tried to get the 212, but now you can buy them for like.
Really? Oh yeah, because they don't give those out, but you can like or.
Yeah, whatever, you can't. Yeah. You can't get one from like AT&T, but there's like a service where I'm just like, fuck it. I don't know. I have like 3 phone numbers at this point now.
Yeah, I don't, how big do you have like your? I know you have artists come in here and work a lot. Do you have like a team, or how many people are helping you on projects
at a time? I have a really amazing team. Like I'm painting this building this week, and I've got, you know, my buddy Lewis that helps like a lot of other big artists fulfill their big projects. It's like he's like the go-to guy for like big murals and walls and stuff like that. I don't do a lot of big murals and. Like our full buildings. This is going to be the biggest thing that I've done.
Is this like a city side, like a building in the city? Yeah,
a friend of mine just put a lease down for a new company. Can't really say what yet, but he leased this building that's in Soho. So hopefully this week we get the green light. We're still going through permitting and all that stuff, but I'm just going to be up there for the whole week just throwing paint on. It's like the 3 sides, like a full building.
Oh wow!
Front, back, and side.
Oh shit! Yeah. I want to see some of that process. I always wonder, like,
it's gonna be fun. I mean, we got, like, you know, the lifts and the whole fucking nine going.
Do you know a lot of the artists that do that stuff around the city? Like, how, what's that that I'm trying to, that the connectivity amongst the artist community?
I was never really, like, big into the art world. Like, yeah. I kind of, like, you know, I always hung out with, like, you know, skateboarders and musicians and stuff like that. Like, the art world where I was from was kind of more of, like, nerdy sector.
That's fair. Like, it's true.
Academic artists and stuff like that. And I was never a graffiti artist. So a lot of, like, you know, the kids that, like, I hang out with a lot of them now that I know them.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the academic artists and stuff, like, nothing against them. I wish I would have done it, because those are the ones that are making more money than anybody. But it was just never my thing to, like, go hang out at galleries and go to art talks and shit like that, you know?
Yeah. Do you have favorite artists?
I feel like every artist should be their favorite artist more than anybody. Like, if I had to have a choice, I would look at my own stuff. Like, that's what
yeah.
You know, you have to make stuff that you love first. But I have a lot of other artists that I admire, like, living and dead, you know.
Who's the ones that are dead? I probably don't know a lot of the contemporary artists.
I mean, like, I, you know, who like, passed. I mean, all the greats, like, oh man, I could give you, like, a whole list of people. Just off the top of the head, like, I've been loving, like, looking at Rauschenberg's. Like, he has a big influence with, like, printing and mixed media works. I love Richard Prince right now. Like, I've been looking at a lot of Richard Prince. He's great. I just love his attitude. Like, I like artists that have, like, more of, like, their persona more than their work.
Okay. You know? I feel like that's a very, yeah. Yeah. Do you do a lot of gallery showings here in the city, or not so much?
I haven't done in a long time. Like, I always used to do, like, I would spend some time doing, like, you know, my fine art and then commercial art, fine art. And then, like, they would balance each other out. And then the last few years, I've just gone so commercial.
Yeah.
You know, but I consider, like, if I do a stage for a musician or I design a tour, that's my gallery show, instead of doing, like, a white wall gallery. And I think it's much more fun for people to come and enjoy the artwork if I have, you know, Miss Hill performing in front of it, and, like, or do a music festival or something. It's more, you know.
What sets or, like, festival shows or things that you've done for her or anybody else that you'd like?
Favorite thing I've done recently, I did a thing with Angus Cloud right before he passed, and Rockstar Energy Drinks, where we took over Lot 11 Skate Park in Miami during our Basel. And I brought in, like, $500,000 worth of lights and LED screens, and, like, basically turned the skate park into a music venue. So we had all the best skaters and everybody, like, skating the park while we had DJs and musicians playing. So it was, like, combining, you know, all my favorite shit into one.
Did he skate, Angus?
Angus, he could skate a little bit, I think.
You still skate?
I don't skate at all. I tore my ACL, like, a couple years ago, and I was like, all right, I think I'm done. I'll roll around a little bit, but definitely nothing.
How was he? I feel like he's, I mean, obviously awful. He passed, but, like, I feel like he was one of those that was just about to hit a stride.
Oh, yeah. That was, like, definitely was just, yeah, that was unexpected, because he was on such a great, like, trajectory with everything. Like, he had so much shit upcoming, and then it just out of nowhere, which is really sad. But a lot of those people that are like that, like, I think he was so effortless with everything that he did. He was just him.
Like,
there was no acting for any of his characters. That's the best thing, is, like, he got to play himself in all these roles. I actually just went back and watched Euphoria, like, a couple weeks ago, just, like, out of nowhere. Like, I'd only watched it when it first came out.
Yeah.
And I never, like, done the full thing, like, all at once. And then I just, like, I happened to see it, and I pressed play, and I just got stuck on it. Like, that's such a good show.
There's two types of, like, actors. The ones that are so authentic and it works, and there's others that are authentic and they become a success, they pop, but then we in turn see that, oh, they're just a one-trick pony and it's not good. Like, I don't want to bash her, but it doesn't fucking matter. What's that? The Twilight chick, Kristen Stewart.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone's like, oh my gosh, she's so good as Bella. She did this beautiful job in Twilight. Her and Robert Pattinson, they're like the it, you know, acting duo. And then we obviously have seen Pattinson's trajectory. He's a fucking superstar. And then you would just see her act in other things. And it's just, oh, her range is just that. It's just her. And it's not a good thing. Meanwhile, Angus, you could put him in anything and he'll be himself. But it's just, there's something different where it's just like so purely authentic. It's like you can't teach that. Yeah, that's just it is. It purely is.
Like some dude, like, you know, most guys that you know like that, you're just like, oh, like I can't even spend like hang out with you too long. But there's something about him. He's just like, yeah, he's just like so chill and so laid back, and just like those little fucking nuances are just like,
yeah,
know, so lovable. He's such like a lovable, like, you know, a lovable unlovable dude. You know,
in those corporate like opportunities, who else have you worked with or like met with in that capacity?
Like as far as like personalities?
Yeah.
Shit. Like, I don't know. So many different people. Like, you know, I've done stuff with like a lot of like, I don't know, more like as far as like art projects, I did a lot of stuff with like a lot of like different models and stuff. I went through a period where I was like, you know, doing a lot of beautiful women artworks and stuff. And then I got out of that because like I realized a lot of collectors have wives and their wives don't want pieces of artwork of other women on their walls. So I got out of that for a bit, but fuck, I'm trying to think of who else. I don't know.
Yeah, like how many phases, if you were to line up, if you were to pick a piece from like each phase of your career, like, you know what I mean? In terms of like Picasso was, you know, this phase, the blue phase, this, like, do you have like moments that represent where you were specifically at one point during your career?
I think they all kind of trail into each, and like they all build on top of each other. So when I first started using the printing machines,
yeah,
that was my first thought, was like, okay, like if I can get beautiful women and work with model agencies and stuff like that, then that'll get the outreach of the artwork out to people. And then from there I started working with a lot of photographers, and then once I got that style known, then I started getting offers from a lot of other amazing photo collections. Like something that is just coming back around, one of my close friends and collectors, he bought all of Astrid Kircher's photographs, and that was George Harris. Like, she used to date Stuart Sutcliffe, who was John Lennon's best friend, that they started the Beatles together.
Yeah, man. So checks out.
Yeah.
You know, how'd they do? Yeah.
So Stuart was known as, like, when they were 18, and then he was also a painter, and then he passed away when they were very young, and then Astrid stuck around, and then she started dating George. And she was known as like the first, she was the one that was credited with giving them their like their dumb bowl cuts and stuff like that. And she was also developed their aesthetic.
Yeah.
So she like took the first studio shots. She was on tour with them. You know, they would travel together. So over the course of, I can't even remember how long, maybe like 8 to 10 years, maybe even less than that. I need to do the research, but she took like 3,000 photographs on film.
Yeah.
So one of my good friends, we started working together and doing some blue chip sales. I would just help him find collectors or, you know, liaison different sales. And then he came to me and he was like, wow, I really like this printing process that you have going. I have this collection of photographs. Could you do something with these?
Never before seen, right?
Well, a few of them have been published. A few, like maybe like, you know, 10 to 15 of the photographs have been published and like sold through Morrison Hotel Gallery and whatnot. So then we had the idea, like, you're sitting on 3,000 photographs. And so he had gone to Astrid. Astrid was getting a little bit older, and she started entertaining the idea of like selling off her collection.
Yeah.
So she was going to sell one photograph for this much, one photograph for this much. And he went to her and he was like, no, let me buy the entire collection and I'll maintain the collection and maintain the integrity of it and, you know, make sure it just doesn't dissipate into the world of the collectors. So we bought the entire lot of photographs, all her negatives, everything. And we did a show together in Bologna, Italy at Palazzo Fava's museum out there. And Astrid was still alive at this point. She'd never let anybody ever touch her photographs. And so she was timid at first to let me do this printing process to them. And then I did a couple samples and she was like, sick. I love them.
Really?
Let's go. Yeah. So, wow. So I got her approval. We put this whole museum show together and it was like the biggest show of the summer in Bologna, Italy.
What was done to the photos in that process?
So basically her whole, so the song, the Beatles song Babies in Black is about her. So after Stewart passed, she only wore black. Her whole aesthetic was black and white. Very like, you know.
Thought it was about babies in blackface. <That's> a...
Maybe. Yeah. That's the newer version. So anyway, so I did very much like black and white only remixes of the photographs. Like we would call them, I started calling them like the, when I would take old photographs and then do my style to them, I call it remixing the photographs. So I did a whole series of these and then we took, and then we also had the first floor of the museum was all her big blown up photographs, like more classical photo show. And then the whole second floor of the museum was all my remixes of them.
Oh, wow.
And then we had like video content and whatnot. So we did the museum show and she loved it. It was like the last time she ever ventured out from her hometown and went to go visit something. And it was like a huge hit. And then she passed away, I think right before the pandemic or right at the start of the pandemic. So we still have this whole collection. And then after she passed, we kind of were like, what do we do with this? And we kind of sat on it.
Yeah.
So that's one of the big things that I'm trying to resurrect right now. I mean, it's the most amazing collection of photos, like behind the scenes shots of John Lennon, like all these guys like that people have never seen. I think Scorsese actually used a couple of them. He licensed a few of them for the last film that he just did. He just did a Beatles doc that came out a couple months ago. But yeah, we're actually trying to resurrect that project and get it out there.
That's awesome. Yeah. Is that, I mean, would you consider that like, and it sounds like at this point you have a lot of people bring opportunities to you. Is this like a, like kind of like a side, like a passion project sort of thing, knowing like the historical context of.
Yeah. Well, I've had so many other amazing, like from that, once people saw the, I got the blessing to take, to remix photos of the Beatles. Like that's one of the last shots of David Bowie right there that before he passed.
Oh, wow.
The photographer that took that, he granted me, you know, the photos to do whatever I want with. I've done stuff with like, you know, Jonathan Mannion's one of my good friends. He's like, you know, he shot all the covers of Jay-Z's album covers and stuff. We did a show together. A bunch of big photographers have like come to me with their collections. They're like, yo, do something with these. So it's like it opened up a whole new door of like breathing life into photographs, you know.
That's sick. I love that. I love the term too, like it kind of bridging the music world, like saying just remixing a photo is such like a familiar term.
Yeah,
it's like it's the same. This is the product's the same. It's just a, you know, there's a breath of fresh air put into it.
Yeah, like that's why it's weird, because like I told you, like I think I always wanted to be a musician. I just sucked at playing instruments or never took the time to learn them.
Yeah,
but everything with my visuals, I kind of like have like I equate it to like in musical terms, like even when I'm layering the different paintings, like, you know, the way that they're structured, it's like the base layer is kind of like a drum stem. Mm. And then like the layer on top of that is kind of like a bass stem. And then as I'm building layers, it's kind of like building layers in a song. So like I think about that, like, oh, like I should have like a very heavy like bass layer for this. And I'll think about it in terms of like, oh, I'm laying down a drum track.
That's awesome. Is there, speaking of music in the studio, what do you usually create too? Who's usually playing on the?
So I thrive on just hitting shuffle and letting it go most of the time. Okay. And I've been recently, I mean, if you look at my catalog, it's everything from soundtracks to classical music, to hip hop, to rock, to heavy metal, to fucking crazy, weird, experimental shit. And I think that I love just like the randomness of like pressing shuffle and just letting it take me wherever it wants to go. And then a lot of the times I'll if I choose something, it just kind of like I have to choose a vibe, and like it's either jazz or like fucking heavy metal.
Yeah. We walked in today, we're playing some like jazz. I was like, this is like kind of what I would play at home too.
I've been listening to Coltrane's Love Supreme like religiously.
Wow.
If I can, like, before I go to sleep and when I wake up.
It's a great, I mean,
it's like one of my favorite albums. And I like, I've listened to it so many times in the past, and then recently I delved into the whole story about how he produced it and how he made it when he was like in a very like dark place, and he just locked himself away, and out came this fucking God sent gift. And that's kind of like, you know, with a lot of my artwork, like I don't have intention of what I want to make. I just kind of like open myself up to, you know.
Do you believe in that like old artist idiom, like out of the darkest times comes the brightest light? Do you need to you need to go through some fuck shit to put out your best piece of
anything? Yeah, that's why I used to like be like a very like have like a bad case of self-sabotage.
That's
myself,
exactly where I was going.
Yeah. I used to do that all the time, so I feel like I can make my best work. I think the ultimate goal is to get into a place where you can be good and make great
and be happy.
Be happy, make great work, and be consistent. But yeah, even like, you know, recently, like I've just gone through like a lot of dark periods, and you know, out of that, like you, like when you never know how high you can go until you hit the bottom, kind of type shit. So,
yeah,
you know, sometimes a dog just shows up and fucking
Ghost. I wish Ghost was more active on this. He's been
he was hyped earlier.
He was hyped before we hit record.
Now he's just fucking sleeping. It's like, shut up, motherfucker.
Yeah, he's like, whatever. Dude, man, I don't want to take too much time. This is awesome, bro. Like, I love this. This is sick. And I'm super excited to like see, first of all, the building that you're working on.
Oh yeah, that's gonna be good. We should get some footage of that.
Film that. Yeah.
And I've got a lot of cool shit coming up this summer. Like, I'm doing the building, then the Montauk stuff, which is going to be like programming all summer. So we're going to do, I'm trying to fast track stuff so we can get the sculpture done by Memorial Day.
Yeah.
And then I'm doing something with a motorcycle company and a surfboard company. And we're going to have like different rollouts and then, you know, all kinds of other fun shit.
How many projects is too many projects at once? Or like, you know, when does it become too much?
I feel like I always try to take on too much. Like if I just had one project that gave me enough money, I'd be happy. You know, if I could just sit back and just splatter paint and just be, you know, content. I don't know. I'll never be content.
You should. That's the artist. That's it. That's the whole thing.
Yeah. I always want more. No matter how much I get, I'll want more.
We always want more. I want more too. Okay. Yeah, man. Well, bro, this is awesome. I'm so glad. This is a very New York situation. Just a mutual friend and brought us together, and now we're fucking Shout out Kiki. It's the homegirl. French Kiki. Bro, appreciate you, man.
For sure.
Thank you. All right.
Sir.
Something Wrong with the Podcast, episode 16, I think. No voicemails on this one. Ghost, come on, get in the shot. We've got Ghost here. Show us your face. All right, guys. Peace.